Hi, everyone. How are you? It is such a great day to be outside. So one, thank you all for joining us, and thank the weather for cooperating. I'm gonna get us started, and just wanna remind you of why we're here. So May is Mental Health Awareness Month, which is a month that at Bridgewater, we started celebrating a few years ago, and every year, we try to do something different and present a different angle in the spirit of educating our employee population and reducing the stigma around mental health. Stigma is a topic that we'll talk deeply about today with our guest, Gary. We both have some personal experience with that we'll share with all of you. But let me not say any more before introducing our guest, Gary Mendel. So Gary is the founder and CEO of an organization that is near and dear to my heart. It's called Shatterproof. He founded it in 2012, and Shatterproof is a national nonprofit organization focused on reducing substance use disorder and the stigma around it, and really focused on kind of all aspects of the disease, including treatment, making sure there's good treatment centers for people. His work is everything from policy changes, law changes, healthcare changes, and then more spiritual changes about reducing how we think about substance use disorder and reducing the stigma around them. So one, welcome Gary, and thank you for being here. So let's start with you. I'd love to hear from you. How did you become involved in Shatterproof? What prompted you to start it? And why are you so passionate about this?
Sure. Well, Sarah, thank you. It's nice to see you again after we were reconnected recently after meeting just before COVID, I think.
Yep.
So, and it's nice to see all of you. Thank you for coming out and supporting Mental Health Month. In answer to Sarah's question, my career was not in nonprofit work nor healthcare. I actually grew up in the area here. I was raising my family in Easton. I was building one of the larger independent hotel companies in the country and raising my family. And my older son, Brian, became, in high school, he became addicted to first alcohol, then pot, weed. And it became a problem in his junior year in high school, which led to a recommendation that he be taken out of school and go to a treatment program, which we followed that advice. That led to Brian going to 8 different treatment programs over 8 years. He always did well in treatment, but then he would get out and he would relapse. And he tried really, really hard. I remember visiting him one time at a treatment program in Florida. And I flew in late the night before, and I got up really early at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I walked into his room because I just wanted to watch him sleep. I hadn't seen him in 4 or 5 months. And when he heard me come in, I was shocked. He was up. The light was on. It was up. He was laying in his bed, flipping through his treatment book. And he heard me come in. He turned around with that big smile of his and said, "Dad, don't worry. I got this. I'm going to beat it." But addiction always doesn't work that way. A few years later, I was woken up in the middle of the night by my cell phone ringing. And when I picked it up, I was told that my son had just died. He was 25 years old, and he hadn't used a substance in 13 months. And equally tragic, it wasn't just addiction that took my son's life. It was the feeling of shame he had every morning when he opened his eyes, of all day long feeling like an outcast, that caused him to wake up that morning, research suicide notes, write a note of his own, light a candle, and take his own life, alone. It obviously doesn't get much worse as a father. It doesn't get any worse as a father. And as I laid in bed for the first month afterward, just destroyed, I began to focus on two questions. What could I have done differently as a father? What had I done wrong? And also, I had to accept whatever. I had to accept it. What could be done to spare other families of the tragedy that our family had suffered? Could there be some good that would come out of this? So I owned my own business. I had some flexibility. I decided to take what I thought would be 3 months away from my business. And I traveled the country in search of answers to those two questions. I was in Washington, D.C. a lot, meeting with the federal agencies. I traveled around the country meeting with leading experts and researchers. And when I came back after 3 months, I took out a piece of paper. And there were five things I wrote on a piece of paper that stood above everything that I had learned. Number one, I wrote the word big. And what I meant by that was I had no idea. If you had asked me before my son died how many fathers in the town of Easton, Connecticut had a son or daughter addicted to drugs, I would have said, 20 or 30, 10. I had no idea it was the third largest cause of death in this country behind heart and cancer. One quarter of American families, mother, father, son, or daughter, or more than one. So it was big. I wrote number two, children. I learned that most, not all, but certainly more than half of those with a substance use disorder had developed that disease before their 18th birthday, when their brains were not fully developed and able to protect themselves. Not all, but more than half. Then I wrote number three, tragic. And when I wrote that, I didn't mean that my son had died. What I meant by that word tragic was I had learned in that 3 months that in the two decades prior to my son passing away, that our federal government had given grants of about $20 billion to researchers all across the country. And those researchers had successfully used that funding and created wonderful bodies of knowledge. Knowledge that had proven without any doubt through randomly controlled trials, if our communities did certain things, less of our loved ones would become addicted to a substance. Far less, 20 to 40%. And if for those who had developed this disease, if they were treated in our healthcare system with certain protocols that had been proven to work, success rates would be remarkably higher, on par with anyone being treated for heart disease or diabetes or asthma, any other chronic illness. But I wrote the word tragic because all this information was buried in medical journals and hardly any of it was being implemented. As a father, learning about information that could have saved my son's life, either preventatively or through treatment, and literally millions of others, was developed, proven, and sitting in medical journals? Are you kidding me? Coming from a background in business, just couldn't believe it. And then I said, well, how could this be? And I wrote number four, shame and stigma that Sarah mentioned. Because of shame and stigma, there was no national nonprofit in this country like American Heart, American Cancer, Susan Komen, Alzheimer's Association, leading the fight to protect our families. So that was four and five, stigma and no national organization. And when I saw this, it's like, and I looked at all the research that was unused, what this country needed, what our families needed was a nonprofit, not to go pour more money into research, let the federal government do that. Simply take out of the medical journals the research that already existed, block and tackle, basic business practices, and get it out to work. And when I ran simple models, that could reduce the cause of destruction of families by half. So I decided to leave my business, and that's what led to the formation of Shatterproof. I spent a year and a half developing a business plan with experts all across the country, and we launched 9 years ago.
I think some of you know this, but the reason that I met Gary several years ago, right before COVID, is because I have a similar story to Gary. My brother, at age 39, died from a drug overdose. He had struggled with substance use disorder for 2 to 3 years before then. And I sought out Gary, one, when I learned he was local, and two, when I started learning about his organization, really out of to fill a hole that I felt, which is I wanted to help in a way that I felt I failed my brother to do when he was alive. And I think, part of why I want to talk to you more, Gary, about shame and stigma associated both with mental health and with substance use disorder is because I think that played out so strongly in my own family. My brother was totally ashamed of his illness, and it made him hesitant to, one, share with us, his family, what he was going through. It made him embarrassed to go get the treatment that he desperately needed. It made it, after he got out of treatment, he went to a couple of different treatment centers, and he was back 30 days from his last treatment when he overdosed, and he hadn't used in that 30-day period since being in treatment. It made him embarrassed to talk to us about his desires and his struggles during that period of time. And it's a thing that, you know, I think about all the time, about how I failed to help him in the ways that he needed to be helped. And my family and I think about that all the time, because we all feel deeply that sense of how we failed him. And I became so interested in the work that Gary is doing because he's tackling this problem at all different levels. And so I want to make sure we spend some time talking about Shatterproof. So Gary, if you could take us through, once you started the organization in 2012, what did you learn, and then what are you focused on now?
Sure, thanks, Sarah. And I've known about your brother, but we've talked about it in the past, but my condolences again.
Thank you.
Skipping forward to, without going through the 9 years, our work has really morphed into three specific areas. Again, we're not a typical nonprofit, we're run like a business. Three specific tiers of work, pillars of work. Number one, transforming the treatment system in the United States. We're leading the nation in doing that right now. Number two, ending shame and stigma that we've talked about continuously over the last 15 minutes. And number three, empowering families with the information they need in prevention, treatment, and recovery if they need it in their family. And also empowering families to engage with us to help others if they so choose. And all three of those pillars of work is backed up by the leading public policy team in the country, getting public policies changed around the country. Just quickly on transforming addiction treatment, five things. We documented and published our nation's first national standard of care for the treatment of addiction, which unbelievably had not existed. Number two, we built an assessment with the American Society of Addiction Medicine. So if you're looking for treatment, do you need outpatient or do you need residential? No one has any idea. And what additional services you need? Do you need? Do you need mental health services? Do you need medications? 10 questions, anonymous, consumer friendly. You answer those questions. You know whether you need outpatient or residential based on the science of decades of science of the American Society of Addiction Medicine and what services you need. Once you know that, how do you find a treatment program that's following the science versus following old beliefs? We built a quality measurement system that is now live in 11 states, representing 40% of the U.S. population. We just launched it 3 years ago, and it's already grown to 40% of the population. It's launching in Connecticut and two other states in September, so it'll then be 45% of the population. And then next year we'll easily be 55%, more than half the population will be living in states with access where we gather data, triangulate the data, and can show which treatment programs are following science-based care, which are not. Number four, educating providers. President Biden signed into law on December 29th, a bill that we were the lead advocate for the last 3 years, that is now starting December 29th, 6 months ago, is going to require, less than 6 months ago, every doctor in this country, essentially, to have 8 hours of education in the treatment of addiction. And then number five, the payment models. We picked up on a payment model that had been proven to improve outcomes. The way that providers are paid, this model improves outcomes by almost 50%. And we've taken it from about 25% of the population to, by the end of this year, we'll be at about 80% of the population living in states with this model that's been activated and up and running. So that's the five pillars of transforming the treatment system. Stigma, I'm trying to keep it short. McKinsey worked with us for over a year pro bono, and we studied 100 pieces of published literature, 11 social movements, and had interviews for an hour and a half each with 50 experts who went through those movements and developed a plan to do it for addiction. It's essentially simplifying it. Three things that our society needs to do: educate in a certain way, change language in a certain way, and change policies. And if we can get six sectors of our society to do so, that'll be the 80-20 rule and get a lot of it done. And we've identified six sectors of our society to do so. We launched in one of them during COVID in the state of Pennsylvania, public stigma, partnering with the state of Pennsylvania. The results, we ran the program for a year of educating in a certain way and language change in a certain way, and the results were the best ever documented. The state then extended their funding, all paid for by the state, for three more years. We picked up Kentucky. They funded us for a year. The results were so good, they just extended it for another year. California just gave us funding for 2 years. We launched a month ago. And then Georgia, we launch next week. And that's also funding for 2 years to run it. We're talking to Michigan. It's really working. And then we just got a $5.5 million grant from Anthem, now called Elevance, to move into a second sector to reduce the stigma that healthcare professionals have toward their patients and the medications that treat it. And then we'll keep adding sectors as our funding grows. That's stigma. And then educating, we have a wonderful Find Help section on our website where people can get great resources and learn. We also have a program called Just Five. And so we have wonderful educational resources, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the things we do, and we have policy work that's backing up all of this.
Thank you, Gary. It's incredibly impressive, the impact that you and your team have had. I want to shift gears a little bit. It is Mental Health Awareness Month, so I want to talk a little bit about, Gary, your thoughts on the intersection between substance use disorder and mental health.
Sure. When I studied this back in 2012, that year that I was developing our business plan and really learning, what was a fact at that point, which was kind of intuitive, that there's about a 50% crossover. About 50% of the people with a substance use disorder also have some form of mental illness. It's less clear what drove which first. I'm sure it's both, and I'm sure there's a lot, large percentages of both, but there's not solid research on which came first. And that was 11 years ago. I suspect post-COVID it's even higher, because everything was blown out of proportion as people were isolated at home. And even now, still working remotely often, it's got to be higher. So a big intersection. When we formed our nonprofit, we didn't want a message that we're a nonprofit related to both, because there's already some organizations doing mental illness, and drugs and alcohol is plenty. But everything we do essentially, programmatically, is both. Our national standard of care, 6 of the 8 principles of care and our national standard of care relate to mental health as well. So everything we do, it weaves in. But we are the organization in the country related to drug and alcohol addiction. That's what we're known as, even though we're doing both.
Yeah. I want to spend a little bit more time. We've talked about stigma, Gary, a lot. I have my own personal experience with it. Right. I know you do too. It is the part of your organization that I became most passionate about. So I'd love to hear from you a little bit more about your personal kind of reflections on stigma and what you're doing about it.
Sure. Well, Sarah, the story you told about your brother is what's happening all over the country every single day. To really understand stigma, we spent 2 years developing, all based on science, with leading researchers in the country at Indiana University, the most comprehensive measurement of addiction stigma that has ever been developed and fielded with results. And what it showed was 75% of the people in this country don't think addiction is a disease. Most think it's bad character. 61% of the public is unwilling to have someone known to have a substance use disorder as their friend, coworker, or neighbor. 60%. 35%, if they know that someone has a substance use disorder and in recovery, meaning they hadn't used a substance in longer than a year, still 35% are unwilling to have that person as a friend, a coworker, or a neighbor. And that gets internalized. People with this disease are not reading a survey, but they can feel it. And if they can feel that 75% of the public doesn't think they have a disease, 2/3 think they have bad character, 60% don't want to be their friend, coworker, or neighbor, or if you're in recovery, still 35% don't want to have anything to do with you as a friend, coworker, or neighbor, many will internalize it and believe the public's right. I'm not worthy. I'm not worth it. I'm ashamed of myself. 35% of those with this disease are ashamed of themselves. Ashamed of themselves. 35% of those with this disease think they themselves have bad character. And I'm talking about people who have not used a substance for more than a year. That is unjust, unfair, and a killer. So if you're Sarah's brother, or anyone with a substance use disorder, or my son, are you going to go to treatment? No, you don't want anybody to know. And you might not even think you're worth it. And if your family finds out and convinces you, can you find a treatment program that is based on science? Probably not, because it was never taught in medical school. Until now it will be. But up until now, it never has been taught in medical school on any kind of regular basis. So can you find providers that know the science? No. Is it covered by health insurance the way it's covered by other diseases? It should be. By law, it should be, but it's not always. But then you internalize it, and you can go to the best treatment program in the country, fully paid for. But if you're living in this world where you think most people don't want anything to do with you, you're not going to do very well. And let me say one last thing. We always talk about the third largest cause of death in the country. Over 200,000 people in this country died last year related to drugs and alcohol. But there's 46 million people living who aren't dying, living subpar lives because they're ashamed of themselves, many of them. And I'll close with the best part of it, the worst and the best part of it. We can change it. We studied 11 social movements. We know exactly how to change it. And it's working in Pennsylvania. It's working in Kentucky. It's going to work in California. It's going to work in Georgia, then Michigan. We're going to be in 23% of the population, assuming Michigan comes on board. And then we're going to start, and we're going to change healthcare professionals, as I mentioned, with Elevance. Prove that works and scale that. Companies, healthcare system, media entertainment, move to every sector, and we can change it.
Gary, what's the? Can you share an example of one of the other stigmas that you studied and how that was addressed?
Perfect example is you couldn't even join the Boy Scout. When Bill Clinton was president, you couldn't even join the Boy Scouts if you were gay. And now you can run for president. Well, what changed? It was the messaging. They had a little bit different twist that worked. They kept trying. It wasn't working. Trying. It wasn't working. This is not fair. This is not right. And when they changed their messaging to this is about love, it's not about getting married. It's about two people have the right to love each other. Everything flipped. It worked. They picked up momentum and it worked. So that's an example of one thing that worked. Another example is AIDS. People think AIDS changed when Magic Johnson came out and it said, I have AIDS. No, it didn't change when Magic Johnson came out. It changed a couple years later when Magic Johnson was on the court sweating with nine other people, saying this is a treatable disease. We never talk about how addiction is a disease. That's not going to help. No, addiction is a treatable disease. If it's not treatable, you still don't want the person as your friend, coworker, or neighbor. But if you know that there's 25 million people living in recovery, maybe some of you right here living wonderful lives, those are the stories that change the public opinion that, yeah, you can be a friend, coworker, neighbor. Many people are treated or living beautiful lives. That's what worked.
That's great. Thank you. We've spent a lot of time talking about folks who have substance use disorder, and I want to talk a little bit about those who love them. You and I are two examples of that, but I'd love to hear, Gary, your advice for anyone listening. If they know someone who needs help, like what advice do you have for them?
Sure. Great question. The first thing is you're already doing it. You're here. Bridgewater as a company is doing it. And then you're all joining the invitation and being here. So that's number one. Number two is learn. I was advised by every treatment program, Gary, stop reading so much, stop asking questions. We're the treatment program. We know what we're doing. If your family member had heart disease, you can maybe listen to that. Because doctors are taught in medical school and they do follow the science, usually. But with this disease, it's way behind. So if you're told, if your family member, if you have any issue in your family with this, read yourself and learn yourself and ask a lot of questions and get multiple opinions. And if you're looking for treatment, go to our quality measurement system. It's on our website in the Find Help section where it says Find Treatment. And you can find out, do you need residential or outpatient? What services are need? And find a provider that's offering evidence-based practices. If you don't go to our website and do that, you can't. It doesn't exist. So number one, you're already doing it. Number two, learn. Number three, empathy. I can go to sleep every night knowing that I had a great relationship with my son. He told everybody, my father's my best friend. I can go back and look at all the letters were back and forth when he was at treatment programs. Brian, I love you. Dad, I love you. The love was back and forth all the time. But I cannot go to sleep knowing that I never said to him, how does this feel? If he had cancer, you know how many people would have said to him, this must be hard. All your friends are off going to college, getting jobs, and you're in bed taking with chemotherapy. How does it feel, Brian? Everyone would have said that, and they would have been, we're so proud of you. You're fighting through this. I never said that. I never asked him, how did it feel? I just said, you just relapsed. It's okay. Let's get you into another treatment program. Maybe this time it will click. Maybe something you learned in the last one will help you. Maybe you can try a little harder. It's okay. But I did not empathize. And I have to live with that. And I can't change it, but I can give it to others. And number four, come out to our events. Bridgewater is forming a team to come to our walk in New York City. so much of what we do in today's world is digital. There's nothing like being with you here today in person. And there's nothing like coming to a walk where there's 2,000 or 3,000 people. And there might be a couple hundred struggling with addiction, and the rest are friends of a family, friends of them, corporate teams. And the love and support in person is just, can't change it. Can't replicate it.
I went to one of the New York City walks, and it is exactly as you describe. It is a shared community of people who care deeply about this issue and want to help Shatterproof succeed further. And it is a wonderful event, and we are thrilled to be able to put together a Bridgewater team. So if any of you would like to join us, we'd love to have you. And I'll just share before we close, Gary and I were chit-chatting before we sat down to talk to all of you. And I shared with him that I was thinking, as I was getting ready this morning, I was thinking about my brother and wondering, like, what would he think about the fact that I'm sitting here today and having this conversation with Gary and with all of you? And I was reflecting that I hadn't thought about my brother in, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks. And it both made me sad to think that I hadn't thought of him in a couple of weeks. And then it made me really motivated and excited to have this conversation with you, because this is what Gary and I were saying. There is something about feeling the sadness of their loss that feels good in some ways, to like sit in that sadness and be, and it's like, it's almost a way of remembering him for me. And so I use some of those moments to keep going. So I know we're about out of time, Gary. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank all of you.
It's wonderful what you and your organization are doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And thank all of you for being here. This is not about me. This is about what we all do together. And this is not some incurable disease that we have to wait 2 decades for some medication. This is helping people today. And we can all do it together. So thank you all for caring and being here. Thank you.
Thank you.